She's got the intellectual property on this, not me. There's 165 miracles in this room.
Oh.
So I just want to say that and just spend a minute saying, seriously. Anyone that gets their bum on a seat in a 12-step meeting is a miracle, and you're in the solution, not the problem anymore. So a little bit about why I was here. I don't remember a time when I wasn't an overeater. I can think about, was it nature, was it nurture? Who knows? But I remember food being a huge part of my life. Always hungry, and shame. Yeah, shame. I didn't really understand shame, but from a child being the chubby child around the pool, knowing I was sort of different. And my parents, incredibly good parents, really, when I look back, misguided in many, many ways and flawed in many ways, but a lot of love. But my mum was so, she really believed that being slim was the most important thing for a girl, because her life would be easier. My mum was a very, very beautiful, exceptionally beautiful woman, is a beautiful woman. And she, that was her currency out of a very poor family in the East End of London, that she could access different world because she was accepted in the 1950s as like, looked like a movie star. And so for her, it was so important. And she was probably, I think probably an anorexic all her life when I think about it. She's now 93 in a care home, and she's lost a hell of a lot of weight because she's ill, she's dying. And all she wants to say is like, ooh, I'm a size six. You know, this is like, wow, bless her heart. And then my dad was one of us, you know, never found the rooms, the most beautiful man, but compulsive overeater. I have to say, he died of this disease. Let's get real. He had diabetes. He never found the rooms. His overeating killed him. At 69, he didn't see my daughter, and he went through a lot of pain and agony, agonising. But he was a gorgeous person, like we all are. You know, most overeaters are gorgeous people. We just don't treat ourselves particularly nicely. And so I had this very confusing upbringing, and so food was at the centre of everything. And the shame and the guilt was there very early, that I was somehow a wrong person, or I wasn't good enough for not looking like how my mother wanted a daughter to look like. And I was marched to all of the, you know, the slimming clubs. I remember being about 8 or 9 in a church hall with lots of middle-aged women. 8 or 9-year-old kids, I think. Yeah, again, well-intentioned, but probably misappropriate parenting. Then the miracle doctor came to Essex, and everybody was, he was bringing these slimming pills and prescribing children, you know. So at 10, I was put on amphetamines, and that's where my yo-yo dieting really started and the secret eating started. And as somebody shared yesterday, I can't remember the numbers. I'm not great at numbers, but I know that I've probably lost and gained around 40 stone in my life. So that yo-yo dieting and the pain and the agony. I did everything that we all done. And thank God I was 12-stepped. The acorn was planted or dug into the ground, and it took a year for a sprout to come up. And I found myself in a meeting. I just have to do a bit retrospectively. Before that actually happened, I had a business partner who had a party on a riverboat disco, if anyone remembers the Marchioness, which was a terrible tragedy. I was supposed to be on that boat. I've still got my invitation in my grandmother's Bible. You know, it's a sheer higher power thing that I wasn't on that boat at that time, because I was coming on later onto the boat. And it had a tragic accident in the middle of the Thames, and I lost 16 of my best friends that night. They all drowned. I was 22. Young, vibrant, vital, beautiful young people. And of course it was profound. Mm. And for me, at the time, I was 21 stone. And I thought, I'm living, they're not. And going to sort of 16 funerals over 3 weeks, in the most tragic sense, I realised that I owed it to them to live my full life. So that's when a diet actually became obsessive, because I really believed that only being slim would be the answer to me living a full life. And I lost about 12 stone in a year. Guess what? Wasn't happy. The hole in the soul was still there, and that's what brought me into OA, because I remember eating and crying at the same time. I didn't understand how I could get this body, become slim, and I was still so desperately unhappy, because it was one dimension. You know, it's a three dimension. You know, where was the spiritual recovery? Where was the emotional recovery? I shared yesterday about the child abuse. That had a huge impact. And I really believe when that happened, I severed my head. There's a Sylvia Plath poem, isn't there? Severed Head, where my head and my body doesn't connect. It still doesn't, one day at a time. So that's why I can stuff my face and not think what it might be doing in terms of self-harm to my physical body. So my head was severed. So, you know, anyway, thank God somebody recognised me, mentioned 12-step. I had a friend who'd gone into AA the year before, and I'd seen this incredible transformation. I knew the relationship between 12 steps in different ways. And I found myself going to a Swiss cottage meeting on a Thursday night. And there were two things that I took from that meeting. The first thing was, welcome to Overeaters Anonymous, welcome home. That's, I still cry at the idea of that. And I know somebody shared about that yesterday. That was what kept me in. That's what kept me coming back. I found my tribe, and thank God you're all still part of my tribe. The other thing that I remember getting to the point was shitting myself when I read the steps. My beady eye went to step 9, and I thought, no fucking way. But the welcome to Overeaters Anonymous, welcome home, was what brought me back. And I think I just worked out pretty quickly, are you on step 9 today? No, I'm not. You're on step 1. So let's worry about that later. And that's actually what I say to my sponsees now, or any newcomer. Don't worry about anything. Just worry about the step you're on. Just lovingly look at the step you're on and do it thoroughly. Because if you do it thoroughly, you might want to go back and reboot and relook at it. And I'm a great advocate of rebooting the steps. But you won't ever have to do it on that level again. I had to remember I was on a step 1 to be able to do the arrest. And that was actually remembering some really big binges, because I'm not good enough, knowing what was behind the binge, because I'm not good enough, and I really believe that's why I binged. And anyway, so yeah, so I did the steps, and I'm going to sort of now whiz through quite a long time, I did actually also think I'd come in for 12 weeks, do 12 steps and go. I thought that was what it was, and that obviously never happened, because as somebody's here in the room remembers me, I didn't think I was in that long. It sounds like prison. But somebody said that we met 30 years ago, and I was like, really? I thought it was 20-something years ago, so there you go. So it wasn't 12 weeks, was it? So step 9, how I understand it, I really truly believe it has to be done from a very loving place. It shouldn't be punishing. It shouldn't be challenging to the point where it's challenging, because, you know, we're dealing with big stuff, and we're dealing with past trauma, and we're dealing with past things that make us uncomfortable. And I'm going to rush on because I've got 5 minutes. I was also told to use tact and common sense. So those are two things that took away. Why do we do it? Well, for us, you know, for our recovery, it is obviously service to others, but it really is about getting rid of our feels, our guilt, our shame, and our remorse. Those are the pillars of why we do this stuff. And obviously, having a lot of self-forgiveness. So because I've only got 5 minutes left, I'm just going to share a couple, which I think are wrong. One is, I worked for a big blue chip. The one thing, I was a real terrible thief, I've got to say, because from a child I learned to steal to feed my habits. As a child, there was never enough pocket money to buy the sweets and the takeaways and things. And as an adult, there was never enough. So my first job was working for a big blue chip retail company. And I stole money from the till to buy food. So when I left, where do I go with that? I rang up the head office and I said, and they have an HR, I went straight to HR. And they had nobody who dealt with old staff from as way back as I went. But they put me onto the woman that did the pensions. And I said, look, I'm in a 12-step fellowship, explained what it was. And I told her, and I said, I'm willing to pay money back. I don't know how. I said, I do have charities that I give to monthly, because there's a global stealing that I did that I couldn't possibly find those people. Sweet shops that I used to steal from and what have you, tuck shop at school. And she said, she went completely silent. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm going to get, you know, the police are going to become criminal. And she just started, she was weeping. And she said, it's the most beautiful call I've ever received in my career. Thank you, you're forgiven. So that was beautiful. The other one is when I left home very early. I explained the circumstances were really tough at home. And I had a landlord, and at the time, you got paid, you know, I didn't pay him. Mm. And I, you know, was a terrible tenant. And I kept on shortchanging him and making excuses. And actually, he was really kind. And he said, look, you know, what I'll do is rather than you pay me the back money of the rent, I'll just put up the rent a little bit, what you can afford. Thank you.